Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're a fan of this show, I'm going to guess you're also a fan of music, and probably seeing live music in concert. But how often do you think about what happens before the show, like earlier that day when the band arrives, or even right before the show when the band is hanging out backstage? What are they eating, or drinking, or reading? Well, as those in the music industry know, a lot of what goes on behind the scenes is dictated by something called a tour rider, which is basically a fancy term for a list of stuff that bands want. Later in the show, as part of our How to Be Smarter series, we'll dive into the world of tour riders, which, as you might suspect, can get a little weird. But first, if there's a founding myth to rock and roll, it's the idea of the lone visionary, in this case the Mississippi bluesman Robert Johnson, selling his soul to the devil in return for fame and fortune. The writer Peter Biebergall says, in fact, without all this soul selling, or at least the appearance of it, rock and roll would never have become rock and roll. Peter is the author of the new book Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll, and I'm happy to welcome him back to the Soundcheck studio.
John, Peter, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
First of all, let's define the term occult, because you go to great lengths in the book to say that the word has come to mean something very narrow, and you use it in a much broader way.
That's right. I'm really trying to talk about something called the occult imagination, which I think includes not only beliefs and practices that people have, but also the way in which people respond to those beliefs and practices. So, say, a Christian fundamentalist that sees something like a Black Sabbath album being demonic, that's also part of this broad occult imagination. But it's also the way in which these ideas, these symbols, get expressed in culture, in music, in art, and in this case, rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Now, the word occult, I mean, it literally means hidden.
That's right.
So it seems like as you go through the various, you know, you go from the Beat Poets to Bowie to T-Rex to the jazz, the astral jazz of Sun Ra, that these things are hiding in plain sight often.
That's right. It seems to be. And sometimes there is a deliberate sense where the musician is trying to, I think, activate something in their fans or the media's sensibility that alerts them very quickly that they're dangerous, that they're different, that they're pushing up against the mainstream. Or maybe it's sometimes just their own inspiration. Maybe something, say, in the way of Donovan, who was influenced not necessarily by the occult per se, but by the myths of the British Isles, or just a whole sense of a romantic return to nature and to simplifying things.
Guinevere of the royal court of Arthur, draped in white velvet, silk and lace, the rustle of her gown on the marble staircase, sparkles on fingers slender and pale, the jester he sleeps, but the raven he peeps through the dark foreboding skies o'er the royal town.
It strikes me that a lot of the artists you focus on in the book are English, but the roots of this you trace back to American slavery.
What you have in particular with the slave songs is that even though their worship was Christian, the ways in which they worshiped were taken, I think, directly from their African traditions, which, according to the Christians of the time, would be pagan, barbaric. But it really was the worship of their gods that we can hear, not in the lyrics and not in, I think, what their intention was, but in the sound and in the rhythm and in the style and the energy of the way in which they worshiped comes directly from those pre-Christian African traditions.
So you talk about slaves, shout songs, but you also talk about the circles, the circle dance.
The circle shout.
You hardly ever even lift your foot off the ground. It's this kind of shuffling thing, very earthy, very rooted, very ancient. And so this becomes part of the DNA of the blues, and then the rhythm and blues, and then Elvis Presley. And at a time where rock and roll is beginning to seem kind of limp and flaccid around the early 60s, that DNA, that becomes the material for that saves rock and roll.
That's right. I think so. And I think obviously it's because it was in many ways the blues that inspired English rock and roll, that they drew from that. There was something about those rhythms and that way of capturing what they wanted to express in music. But you see, say, even with something like Led Zeppelin, that they saw that there was a rich mythological tradition in their own land, in their country, that they could draw a different kind of inspiration from, more of a spiritual inspiration.
So the opening of your discussion of Led Zeppelin is the mastering engineer trying to engrave on the master disc the phrase from Aleister Crowley, "Do what thou wilt." You know, that this shall be the whole of the law. And he's engraving it onto the master of Led Zeppelin III. You know, it's like this hidden occult message. But Robert Plant, at the same time, is drawing on Celtic mythology. He's from an area near Wales. He's fascinated by the Western Shore and things like this. So there's a kind of confluence of several different non-mainstream spiritual practices here. Zeppelin III, that is Immigrant Song. You hear the reference to the Western Shore out of Celtic mythology, the Hammer of the Gods out of Norse mythology. It's occult because it is not the mainstream spiritual practice of the time. Is that?
That's exactly okay. Right. And that's right. Really why I'm trying to broaden the idea of this, because really what I'm talking about is at its core, a kind of spiritual rebellion.
Yeah.
And this we see, of course, in this interest for the hippies in particular, in Eastern mysticism, that they needed a spiritual identity that was not bound up in the Judeo-Christianity that what they perceived as ruined the world after World War II. They needed something different. And so they many times looked to the East with those kinds of practices. Now, I think in a very dictionary definition term, Eastern mysticism would not be included in the word occult. But I wanted to include that because it became part and parcel to the idea of the occult in the 60s.
So you talk about the Beatles and, you know, the Maharishi and going to India and studying transcendental meditation and actually kind of doing a bit of proselytizing on behalf of TM. That seems to be kind of a turning point in that, and, you know, people like Donovan doing Season of the Witch. I mean, that period in the mid-60s, everything seems to be coming together there.
That's right. There was and I think because there was a desperation for meaning in a world that seemed out of control. What's interesting is that even though the hippies maybe were opposed to organized religion, they didn't want to give up on some religious identity. It wasn't willy-nilly. Now, it was, you could say, a Pandora's box, as it were, of all these different spiritual ideas. But they were looking for some way to ground these ideas that felt like there was an ancient wisdom attached to them.
So when you hear a song like Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles, what is the relationship between the texture of the song, the very odd sonic surface of the song, and the kind of spiritual and lyrical underpinnings?
Well, the tool, it seems, beyond spiritual practices was, of course, LSD. And it's an interesting thing that there's something about Eastern mysticism and the occult that gave a language for the LSD experience. They provided a very nice grammar for which to understand an experience that can often feel out of control. But a lot of those ideas, particularly in Eastern mysticism, are about ego disillusion, breaking down the self, having a sense of oneness with the universe. And so you can, these things went together very well. And I think the music expressed that kind of energy that you get from the mixing of these things.
Pinnacles of 60s psychedelia, Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. Peter Biebergall is with me on Soundcheck. His latest book is called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. How much of this is marketing and how much of this is a genuine kind of spiritual search on the part of the musicians?
I think sometimes it's hard to separate those things because I think, for example, somebody like Jimmy Page who writes that or has his engineer carve the Crowley missive on the inner groove and hires Hypnosis to do these amazing album covers.
They did album covers for like Peter Gabriel. I mean, they were the famous LP cover art group.
That's right. And they did the wonderful, creepy Houses of the Holy cover with the children crawling up the stones. And so there's a sense that, again, that I think that he had a genuine interest in these things.
He bought Crowley's mansion, you wrote.
He bought the mansion. He bought all these rare volumes. And that's how he actually met the filmmaker Kenneth Anger, was because they were bidding on the same Crowley volume at an auction house. So I think that he had a genuine interest in it. Mm-hmm. But I also think that he understood how using these things was a way of creating a mythology and a mystique around the band.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was cynical necessarily. I think you might get that later.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is this really interesting give and take with recognizing that this is going to impact culture.
An interesting example of that, and one that you allude to several times in the book, is the song Mr. Crowley by Ozzy Osbourne. Now, of course, he comes out of the band Black Sabbath, who from note one of album one of that band are kind of putting you in this very sinister, very satanic kind of place, not kind of celebrating it, but to really kind of scare you. And in Mr. Crowley, you're just not sure. I mean, is Ozzy having one over on us? Is he having some fun with us? Is he serious? What's going on here?
I think that he was absolutely having fun, but I also think that he recognized, both as a very smart performer, as somebody who knew that there was a way to sell albums using this kind of imagery, but that there was a real connection between him and the audience when you conjure this spirit, when you conjure these kinds of feelings. And I think when you're a musician up on stage and the flames are exploding behind you and you walk down your throne and you're singing Mr. Crowley, you feel it too. You feel it also. And afterwards you get it was all in fun. But I think something happens. Something gets evoked between the musician and the audience that I've said many times, I think is very similar to what happens when we go to see a magician perform their act. We know it's fake. We know there's nothing supernatural going on over there. But we want that experience of being transported and being hypnotized.
Well, it's a very ambiguous song. It's got lines like, "Hey, Mr. Crowley, won't you ride your white horse?" It's symbolic, of course. Let's hear a little bit from Ozzy Osbourne.
Mr. Crowley, what went on in your head? Oh, Mr. Crowley, did you talk to the dead? Your lifestyle to me seems so tragic.
A little bit of the song Mr. Crowley by Ozzy Osbourne, post-Black Sabbath, post-Black Sabbath version 1.0 anyway. Peter Biebergall talks about Ozzy and Black Sabbath and Aleister Crowley and the history of the occult in the West in his book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. So you end up with bands like Hawkwind and Into the Future, the kind of astral star child imagery of Yes and Pink Floyd, and also the kind of back into the sort of neo-pagan naturalism, animism, all of that stuff. And all of that actually comes into play with Syd Barrett's Pink Floyd, the early days of Pink Floyd.
Yeah, I think in some ways he became, Syd Barrett in particular, really became a vessel for all the hopes and fears of the counterculture, the way in which there was a combination of using LSD as a tool to get at these other spiritual ideas. But I think it also, that search, that desperate search, can sometimes be a dangerous one. And we see that really with his disillusion of his mind and what happened to him personally.
Right. He became a very famous psychedelic casualty. And but these were kids, you know, and they were sort of making it up and trying things out as they went along.
Absolutely.
Peter Biebergall's book is called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. It is a very interesting read. Peter, thank you very much for joining us again.
John, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Up next, time for us all to dive into the weird world of tour riders. We'll hear about those lists of demands that artists make for equipment and food
including Van Halen's legendary backstage ban on brown M&Ms. It's the latest in our How to Be Smarter series. And cellist Maya Beiser stops by later in our studio to give her take on some classic rock songs from the likes of Janis Joplin and Led Zeppelin. All of that coming up on Soundcheck.
I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-T.
And I want to spend!
Damn it, you have to be smarter than that.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. So, you've bought tickets to a big rock show. You get to the theater, buy your outrageously overpriced beer, the band gets on stage, and you have a great time. End of story, right? But what happens before the band even gets there? Who's in charge of making sure they stay there to do the show? Well, today, we're going to find out. Jack McFadden is a talent buyer for Austin City Limits Live and the concert venue known as the Belmont in Austin, Texas. He also spent many years booking bands here in New York. He joins us on the line from Austin to tell us how to be smarter about tour riders. Hi, Jack. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, first of all, explain two things. What is a talent buyer and what is a tour rider?
A talent buyer books the shows. It's that simple.
Okay.
It's kind of a more corporate name for someone who books a club. And the rider is, there's a technical rider and there is a hospitality rider.
So these are part of the contract that you enter into with the artist.
It definitely is. It is. There's, it can be as elaborate as 40 to 50 pages. It can be as simple as one page, but it definitely is part of the contract.
And what is the point of the technical and the hospitality tour rider?
Well, I think it's from load in to load out, there's no surprises. So mm-hmm. The venue is prepared and the band is prepared. What the agent will do is once we book the concert, they'll send us the riders to make sure that we understand where the band is coming from. And, you know, these bands are on the road all the time, and so, you know, there are many villages. I mean, we just did a show with Counting Crows, and there's 40 people on the road with them. So we're kind of their, you know, home base, and we're feeding them, you know, maybe three meals a day, and they're here on the premises for several hours. So we want to take care of them and make sure that they have what they need. And right.
So if one person is vegetarian, another person's vegan, another person's gluten free, another person keeps kosher,
it'll be there right on the rider.
It'll be in the rider, and it's your job to keep the artists happy so that they actually show up on stage when they're contracted to. Some of these riders have become famous because it's like, you know, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. I mean, we had a very big band that performed downstairs in our venue, the Green Space, and let me read you some of what they requested in their rider. And this is not particularly outrageous. Tea service with hot water, 48 cold bottles of quality premium beer, 50 drink tickets, 2 bottles of red wine, 4 cans of Red Bull, not sugar-free, 1 bag of tortilla chips with salsa, extra points for good salsa instead of national brand, 4 cartons of coconut water, 1 copy of the New York Times, 1 block of Gruyere cheese, 1 pack of Camelite cigarettes, and 12 large clean bath towels. How does that sound to you? Is that fairly typical?
That sounds easy. That's a good one. That's a dream come true, that one.
So do you see a lot of the same things on these riders?
You have different personalities with different needs, and the more people on the road, the more complicated it gets. But you're reading a hospitality rider, and you can see, okay, no paper plates, no plastic cutlery, and that's fine. But when you call also the tour manager a week or two out of the date, he'll give you the scoop. You know, we don't need the chunky peanut butter. That guy's not in the band anymore. These riders are written maybe once before a tour, but maybe once every 4 or 5 years for these bands.
Yeah.
So sometimes they're not relevant.
Well, I have to say, the one very big band whose tour rider I just read to you, they were completely fine with, like, whatever we happened to have lying around backstage. Someone as big as Adele is apparently not hard to keep happy. Her rider requires 2 bottles of the very best quality red wine and 12 bottles of, and I'll quote here, best quality European lager beer, i.e. Beck's, Stella Artois, Peroni, etc. Now, whether that's best quality European lager is very much open to debate, but North American beer is not acceptable to Adele.
Don't you remember?
Jack McFadden's on the line with us from Austin. He's a talent buyer for Austin City Limits Live and the concert venue known as the Belmont there in Austin, Texas. Today we're talking about tour riders, the addenda, that's the plural of addendum, isn't it? The addenda to a standard concert contract that has all your technical needs and your hospitality needs. Jack, you were talking about how, you know, somebody might require a specific bottle of wine, but if you know something better, they're really happy to get that. Reminds me that, you know, we will often get technical riders. You know, the artist insists on this kind of microphone and this model of microphone. We have an amazing collection of microphones here, and very often bands will come in, see what we have, and, the technical rider gets torn up and thrown out the window because they're delighted to have what we've got here in the studio. But the hospitality rider is a thing that people talk about. Now, I want to play something for you, Jack. This is our friends over at Freakonomics Radio talk to a bunch of people involved with one of the most famous tour riders of all time. Take a listen. The first voice you're going to hear is that of Freakonomics host and author Stephen Dubner.
By the early 1980s, Van Halen had become one of the biggest rock bands in history. They had these extravagant live shows with a huge stage set, booming audio, spectacular lighting effects. Their contract carried a 53-page rider that laid out the technical requirements for all of this, as well as other demands.
You know, it lists all kinds of food that they want.
Mike Peden worked for a concert promoter in Syracuse, New York.
Some of the strange ones, you know, various donuts, a dozen hard-boiled eggs. They want Fruit Loops and Raisin Bran. They want real knives and forks. They don't want plastic ones.
Patrick Whitley was Van Halen's production manager at the time, which means he was responsible for that contract rider.
And I think I actually typed that sheet. So,
okay. It looks like an IBM Selectric, maybe.
Yeah,
is that what you owned?
Yeah, probably was.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I really love that you made sure you got your vegetables, or you made sure that somebody got their vegetables. Even days, there were Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, mushroom, spinach, and then odd days, peas, green beans, corn, carrots, and tomatoes. And on it goes. You needed some whiskey and beer and wine, I gather, yes?
Of course.
Some KY jelly. What's that for?
For fun.
There was also a section for munchies. Here's Mike Peden again.
Potato chips with assorted dips, nuts, pretzels.
And in the middle of the munchies section,
M&Ms, and then in capital letters and underlined and in parentheses, it says, warning, absolutely no brown ones.
So that is one of the most famous, you know, elements of a tour rider. People talk about the brown M&Ms. Jack, have you, what's the most absurd request that you've encountered in a tour rider?
Absurd. Well, I mean, it always amazes me when we get requests for socks, clean socks. And I get it because I've been out on the road with bands, but it just confuses me because, you know, that's socks. Okay. Every time I see socks come up, my head almost pops off. I can't wrap my head around it.
Now, back in the 80s when this Van Halen tour rider was touring around with the band, you know, it was a little bit of a different time. Do you see a lot of requests for KY jelly these days on tour riders?
You know, I guess the 80s are over. Not KY. No. It's more like Annie Chun's wasabi seaweed snacks.
Very nice. What happens if these demands are not met? Have you ever seen an artist walk out because the wrong brand of bottled water was in the green room?
Not specifically that, but I've seen artists walk out if they walk into a room and technical specs can probably be the deal breaker.
Yeah.
But again, both sides typically know, unless the club is lying, you know what you're up against before the band loads in. I mean, that's why these are provided, right? And you go over it line by line with the tour manager, and you say, do you really need, you know, 4 bottles of Gatorade at room temperature? Was that right? Is that not a typo? You want to drink Gatorade at room temperature? That's okay. You know what I mean? You just try to cross them off the list, though.
Right. But occasionally, don't you run into someone who, you know, knowing that these tour riders can be really kind of absurdist, just wants to have some fun with it? I mean, Iggy Pop and the Stooges, their tour rider, their technical tour rider, requested, quote, "One monitor man who speaks English and is not afraid of death."
Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a piece. Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll heal your disease. There's nothing in my dream, just some ugly memory. Kiss me like the ocean breeze. Hey!
This is an excerpt from the tour rider from the Brooklyn band Parquet Courts. They also recently played in our venue, the Green Space. This is what they requested. I'm going to read it just straight off the page for you. "One bottle of communion-grade red wine." "One bottle of white wine that would impress your average non-wine-drinking American. One bottle of lower middle-shelf whiskey, cheap but still implies rugged masculinity. Mixers for aforementioned mid-level whiskey of slightly higher quality than the whiskey. A quantity of herbal mood enhancer. One copy of newspaper with the most interesting headline, front page picture, comic section, must feature Curtis."
I love that band. I failed to mention that back in the Bell House days, I do remember someone requesting a golden kitten.
A golden kitten.
As you know, we went out and found a gold kitten in Chinatown. Now it wasn't alive. It was, you know, a gold kitten. But I think they were testing us.
Okay.
And they were so happy to see it backstage.
Now, you can find a lot of these tour riders at smokinggun.com and elsewhere on the net. Now, we were talking before about the famous Van Halen tour rider and this apparently crazy demand that no brown M&Ms are allowed back in the green room. You need all these bags of M&Ms, but the brown ones all have to be taken out. It sounds silly, but here's, again, let's go back to Freakonomics and their host Stephen Dubner for perhaps an explanation of that.
So, why did Van Halen require that the brown M&Ms, dark brown and light brown, be removed from the M&M bowl in their backstage munchies? Was it nothing more than rock star excess, or perhaps a clever way of finding out some information that would otherwise be hard to find? Remember, at the time, Van Halen put on one of the most ambitious live rock shows of anyone. It could be dangerous. You didn't want a light tower falling on you or the stage collapsing under the weight of all that gear. To that end, the band had to trust that the local promoter in each city took seriously the contract rider that listed all the technical requirements for this massive stage show.
Promoters frequently didn't read the contract rider, and we would have structural, physical issues because, hey, there wasn't the proper electricity, load-bearing stress, etc.
So David Lee Roth, as he explains in a 2012 video, claims that he came up with a trick, kind of like King Solomon's trick, to figure out if a promoter had read the rider carefully.
If I came backstage, having been one of the architects of this lighting and staging design, and I saw brown M&Ms on the catering table, then guaranteed the promoter had not read the contract rider, and we had to do a serious line check, because frequently we had danger issues.
Jack, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, at the club level and a big production like that, a lot of things can fall through the cracks. And you just want to be confident as a band going into a venue that everything has been taken care of.
And
so it's important. Load in to load out is a very, very important thing.
And as you've said several times, you as the person working at the venue, you're going to check off each line. You need to check off line by line, make sure that what's done is what needs to be done.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, you can listen to the whole episode of Freakonomics Radio and find out why David Lee Roth was surprisingly King Solomon-like. You can find a link on our website, soundcheck.org. We've been talking about tour writers, how to get smarter about them and kind of figure out what they are and why they are. And Jack McFadden, talent buyer for Austin City Limits Live and the concert venue The Belmont in Austin, Texas, has been walking us through it. Jack, this has been very educational and entertaining as well. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John.
Next, cellist Maya Beiser grew up loving rock and roll, bands like Led Zeppelin and AC/DC, and artists like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. So when it came time to make her latest album, she decided to forego classical works for ones from the rock canon. Maya Beiser plays songs from her latest album called Uncovered, next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Some years ago, the cellist Maya Beiser recorded this arrangement of Led Zeppelin's song Kashmir. A little bit of a surprise coming from a musician best known for her work with contemporary classical composers like Philip Glass and Steve Reich, but it turned out really well. Now Maya has released a whole album of covers of classic rock songs. Well, not covers really, but reimaginings of these old songs. The album is called Uncovered, and Maya Beiser and her trio are going to start us off by uncovering this Led Zeppelin song called Black Dog, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
A solo that I think Jimmy Page himself would be proud of. That is Maya Beiser doing Led Zeppelin's Black Dog, a little bit of heavy metal cello from Maya Beiser, playing both acoustic and electric cellos here in our soundcheck studio today, the electric on that song, with Gian Riley playing the electric bass and Matt Kilmer behind our drum kit. Maya Beiser's most recent album is called Uncovered. Maya, good to see you again.
It's great to see you, John.
So explain what an uncover is.
Well, an uncover is an unusual cover, if you will. In other words, what we try to set up to do in this album was to reimagine those tunes that we all love and to kind of give it the weight that we think it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you're talking now about a song that's been around for 40 years, has withstood the test of time, you know, for over many, you know, several generations and many iterations of music.
Exactly. And so, you know, for me, this is a classic just as much as Bach is and Schubert is. And so, you know, all classical music is covers, as we all know.
But that's true.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
We cover Bach every day, and we cover Schubert and Beethoven.
Do you cover Bach every day? Do you still play Bach every day?
I still do. I do. But this is just for, you know, the privacy of my own home. One day I might reimagine that as well.
Well, because, you know, you have made your reputation as someone who specializes in contemporary music, and certainly, you know, Led Zeppelin and Nirvana and Pink mm-hmm. Floyd and AC/DC and the rest of the gang on this record. That's still contemporary music, although it's been around, as we say, for some decades. Is this music you grew up with?
You know, I grew up in Israel.
Right.
And I grew up as a classical music geek, but listening to a lot of different kind of music.
Well, now, your parents were from originally Argentina, right?
My father's from Argentina. I grew up in an Argentinian kibbutz, heard a lot of Piazzolla as I was growing up. But my mom was French, so she brought Jacques Brel and other people to the mix.
Mm.
Edith Piaf, you know, and all those great guys. So rock music is really, you know, just became kind of, I mean, I started to listen to it when I was 16. And the first time I heard Janis Joplin, it just blew my mind away, John. I mean, I just remember thinking, wow, I want to play the cello the way she sings. And the idea that a woman rocker, you know, and that mm-hmm. kind of the way that she put herself out there was just so great. So she became my hero. I never thought I would actually play her, but when we decided to do this album, I knew I had to do a Janis Joplin tune. And then, you know, all these other guys, that was the music I listened to, you know, in my teens, so.
Yeah. So we began with just a little bit of the version of Kashmir that you did on an earlier record called Provenance.
Right.
You revisit Kashmir again on this new record, Uncovered.
Right.
Now, but that song, the original Led Zeppelin version of Kashmir, is full of strings anyway. You know, it's
right.
got that very exotic kind of mm-hmm. Orchestral sound. But most of the other songs on this record are very guitar-based. And you have gone, I mean, Gian Riley over there is an ace guitarist, but you have refused to allow him to play the guitar in this band. He's playing the bass.
There are no guitars on this album. And, you know, I get people write to me every day saying, wait a minute. We hear guitars here, but there is no guitars. Everything is played on the cello. And, you know, when I did this Led Zeppelin Kashmir, I realized that I really want to be able to play those amazing Jimmy Page solos on my cello.
Which guitar. Is your guitar.
Right. And as you heard, and you know, of course, you couldn't do that kind of approach to guitar without putting a Jimi Hendrix on. So there's a great Jimi Hendrix tune on the album.
Mm-hmm.
So the approach to this album was kind of threefold, if you will. I mean, there was the sound of the cello as the lead guitar,
right.
which, you know, I took on. And we spent a lot of time just trying to figure out how to do that because we recorded everything on my acoustic cello and adding whatever, you know, distortion that we thought would work. The other approach was the vocal, taking the cello, you know, figuring out a way to recreate those, you know, iconic vocalists on the cello.
Well, now this strikes me as one of the biggest challenges to what you are doing here, because let's face it, a lot of rock songs are, you know, if you take away the different vocals of each verse, the song is just repeating itself. You know, the melody comes around, and then you hit the chorus, and the melody comes around, and then you hit the chorus again.
Right.
So,
you know, you if you're taking out the lyrics, you need to create interest, you know, a kind of evolution in the song through another way.
Exactly. And, you know, this album is a collaboration with my friend Evan Zipporin, who's a great musician and I think probably one of the greatest arrangers, especially of this kind of music, but other kind of music. And our first exploration together was a whole gamelan orchestra that we did on cello. I don't know if you remember that. It was an old album that I did. It's called Kinship. And he basically took a kebyar,
which is a type of Indonesian court music, right?
Exactly.
Played on metal percussion.
Exactly.
And you were all of the percussion instruments on your cellos.
Right. So we've done this kind of sonic exploration on the cello, and that's what we wanted to try to do here. And I think that's what makes it interesting, even though, so to strip the lyrics and to really take the music in sort of its pure form, but then to find all these different sonic ways to make it work. And we've done that with, you know, there are like two tracks in the middle of the album which are much more sort of ambient, like Pink Floyd and Epitaph.
The King Crimson song,
The King Crimson song, yeah.
So we're speaking with cellist Maya Beiser. Her album Uncovered is out now with songs by, in addition to the aforementioned King Crimson and Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Howlin' Wolf, AC/DC. You mentioned Janis Joplin. And the song you chose from her repertoire is, in fact, her cover Summertime, the George and Ira Gershwin song.
Yeah, so we're uncovering her cover of Gershwin. We just felt that, you know, it would be great to take a cover that she did and re-uncover it.
Now, for this one, you're going to play the acoustic cello.
This one, I'm playing the acoustic cello, yes.
All right. Well, shall we?
Yes.
All right. Maya Beiser on cello with Gian Riley on bass and Matt Kilmer on drums. This is Janis Joplin's version. Well, this is Maya Beiser's version of Janis Joplin's version of George Gershwin's Summertime, live on Soundcheck. Thank you. That is cellist Maya Beiser and a version of the George Gershwin song Summertime, inspired by the Janis Joplin version of Summertime and arranged by composer and musician Evan Siporin for Maya's record called Uncovered, which is out now. Maya, always great to see you. Congratulations on the new record.
Thank you, John. It's always great to be here.
Tomorrow, celebrate Halloween with Soundcheck and the band Primus. They'll join us in the green space to play songs from their latest album, Primus and the Chocolate Factory. It's a Willy Wonka-themed costume party that you won't want to miss. Visit soundcheck.org to watch video from the show and to see photos of our costumed audience as well. That's tomorrow. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.